Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Without any exception, everything in the world is sacred. That's not the usual understanding. But according to our teachings, according to our practice, and according to our evolving understanding, as we practice, we come to recognize that everything in the world is sacred. The entire universe is sacred, and there is no exceptions. You know, it's not just certain deities that become objects of worship that are sacred, or certain special places, or special objects. And I always chuckle a little bit when I read about or even visit places where Buddhist temples where they have a relic of Buddha, Buddha's tooth in this temple, and so it's sacred. Buddha's tooth is sacred. If Buddha were here, he would laugh at that. Inherently, we all recognize this truth. Even though we may not be aware of it, we do recognize this truth, and that's why we come to practice. We come to practice because we want to fully understand and embrace the recognition that all of space and all of the symbols of the world and all of our practice affirms the sacred nature of all of our activities. Buddhism, of course, emphasizes compassion. Compassion for each other and compassion for animals and compassion for everything. And it is the recognition of the sacredness of all things that gives birth to our compassion and the caring for all beings. The recognition of sacredness is the beginning of selflessness, the root of selflessness. Selflessness is how we bring benefit to others who are the object of our words and our actions. But selflessness is also of benefit to ourselves, because it brings us a mind of peace and serenity. So, Buddhism and this practice offers us the opportunity to feel and to express the sacred nature of the world. So we study the teachings, we chant, as we did tonight, we bow, as we did tonight, and we sometimes make offerings, and we sit on our cushion in Zazen without any goal. all of these activities are practices of giving, an expression of the sacredness of everything. But, however, easier said than done, it is difficult to be selfless and feel the sacred nature of everything because of our desires that come up. You know, we humans have various desires for possessions, for admiration, and for comforts, both physical comforts and emotional comforts. And we have a desire for an easy life, a life where we envision that there is no physical labor or no mental labor. A picture of an easy life. And sometimes we are very stubborn about this desire for comfort. We insist on it, and it can lead us to do things that are not very helpful, that are in fact quite harmful. So our practice offers us disciplines to soften our stubbornness and to set aside our mind, the mind's obsession with desires. These disciplines include sitting in a formal posture with a straight back and a body that does not rely on any outside support. This is a discipline. And we also have the discipline of maintaining a silent mind, a mind with no activity. And we have the discipline of making the effort to come here to sit with others. This is also a discipline. In other words, our practice asks us to give up personal conveniences and personal comforts. When we follow these disciplines, we will indeed realize that our stubbornness is starting to soften. So our practice, our complete practice, is really based on an attitude of giving. If we sit on our cushion with the purpose of gaining something, like peace of mind or wisdom or something like that, this is not selfless. This is trying to gain something for ourself. And this is not practice. But when we can develop an attitude of giving, when we have no goal, when we are not looking for a payback from our practice, this is how we learn how to give to others and to ourselves. So giving, or in Buddhism, is known as dana. It's a Sanskrit word, I think, or word coming from the Pali. It's the first quality of the bodhisattva, the enlightened being. Dana, first quality, giving. Dana means spontaneous, warm-hearted generosity. It is the primary ethical activity of Buddhist monks. giving without reservation. And it is the foundation and the basis for further spiritual growth. And it doesn't matter what is given. We can give money. We can give some material. We can give our labor. We can give our encouragement. If our giving is without reservation, it is dana. We can give our courtesy, and we can provide acknowledgement. We can speak truth always. We can express our gratitude to others for something that they've done for us. We can keep our promises when we make them. We can do things with the best quality that we can possibly can. We can give our attention to each other. And we can just be a quiet presence when we are with each other. All of these things that come from the heart are expressions of dana. You know, it's not just money. So the key to dana is a vow to maintain an attitude of giving throughout our life, to be oriented towards others and not oriented towards ourselves, to have ambition for others and not for ourselves. So dana is really a vow to live this life to benefit each other. And we make this vow because we understand that all things are sacred. So, in our practice, we recognize giving as the way to benefit others, both in a personal way and in a universal sense. In other words, to give, to do something useful when no one is watching. This is the attitude of dana, to do something valuable or useful or helpful even when no one is watching us or no one knows. So dana requires a very large view of the world, a large view of our life. So one of the more interesting aspects of our practice is that when we are doing something that is to be helpful, or when doing something that is to be giving, but it feels like a burden, or it feels like, oh, it's too much effort, there is no joy in that kind of feeling. Doing something that is supposed to be valuable, and that does create value, but it feels like it's a burden. There's no joy there. There's only a feeling of annoyance. And in that case, we cannot feel the sacredness of our life. And this kind of feeling of irritation or annoyance may present itself to us when we are practicing, and we notice it, and we can see what is the barrier. So dana, or an attitude of giving, is a practice. It is the continuous vow to make a difference wherever we can, to honor the sacred nature of all things, and to vow to keep, to try to keep, a mind of giving. The key to this vow, it's hard to keep a vow like that unless we have a vision or a trust of our own inherent bodhisattva nature. We have to trust it. We may not feel it. Don't call me a bodhisattva. I know myself. I'm not that kind of person. But actually we are. And if we trust that we are, and we are working hard to feel it and to express it, giving is our fundamental nature. It is who and what we are. So we make this vow to be selfless and to have a mind of dana, because we are telling ourselves, I have to do it because that's who I am. And I have no choice but to live my life this way. Heard a story, short story, the other day. I was talking to some friends, and a woman said her son, who's in high school, came to her and said, I think I'm going to try vaping. And his mother said, is it because of the kids in school? And he said, yes. And she said, that's not who you are. And that was all that was needed. He said, I'm not going to do that. That's not who you are. Going along with the crowd, not thinking things through, not being focused. That's not who you are. So dana is not just donating to a charity because we feel we should, because everybody else is. It is to see the need to make a difference with our life. Just like the story of Buddha tells us. Dana is how the wisdom of the teachings are expressed in our daily life in very practical ways. So, in a very early Buddhism, the basis of giving was the activity of the monastic community, the community of monks, the monastic sangha, and their relationships with the lay people of the towns and villages where they lived. The monks depended on the lay people for their food, for their clothing, for their medicine, for accommodations. And in return, the monks provided the teaching of the Dharma to the lay people. It was an exchange of giving. And a saying came out of that tradition that says, the holy life is based on mutual dependence. This is a vital teaching and a vital practice. When we live our life that way, it brings us great peace of mind. It does away with stubbornness and ego. It brings us a feeling of richness richness that is independent of wealth. On the other hand, when we lack a spirit of dana, when we are, you know, tight-fisted and stingy, it gives us a feeling of being poor, even though we might have a great deal of wealth. So, in this world, the greatest gift is not something. It's not a thing. The greatest gift is not fooling ourselves or others. The greatest gift is being honest with ourselves. To be just as we are, not trying to be someone else. So the mother tells her son, that's not who you are. Be yourself. The greatest thing, the greatest gift, is to be brave enough to accept ourselves and acknowledge when we make mistakes. And of course, it is foolish to deny that we don't make mistakes. If we fall into that trap, we are only protecting some picture of ourselves. Like covering our photo with a piece of plastic or glass to protect it. And this is a misunderstanding, because our true nature cannot be harmed. If we make a mistake, if we mess up a little bit in our daily life, it's not the end of the world. Our true nature cannot be harmed, even though we may make a mistake. Because our true nature is not a picture that we need to cover up. So if we fall into the trap of ego and we spend our time protecting ourselves, our idea of ourself, we are creating walls. We cannot hear the Dharma when we hide behind walls. When we practice giving, we have no need for defenses. So, I have a short story I'd like to bring to you. It comes from France in the early 1900s. There was a spiritual community, people who lived together. And in a community in the country in southern France. And one day, an old man, elderly man, came to live there. He wanted to live there. And they said, yes, you can join us. It turns out he was a cranky and difficult old man. He was irritable. He was messy. He was always fighting with everyone. Nothing pleased him. And he was unwilling to help. And he was unwilling to clean up. And after several very frustrating months, he left the community and returned to Paris. When the spiritual leader of the community heard that the old man had left and returned to Paris, he immediately followed him to Paris. He found him and he met with him, and he tried to convince the old man to return to the community. And the man said, it's too hard. It's too hard for me. And so he refused. Then the leader offered him a very large monthly stipend to return. Offered him a big salary to return, and the man accepted. And so he came back. When he arrived back and the other people learned about the stipend that the leader had promised him, the other members of the community were astonished. Disappointed and astonished. The old man was getting paid while they themselves had to pay to be there. Unbelievable. And they were up in arms. And they complained to the leader. So he called them together in a meeting. And he listened to their complaints. And they all said, this fellow is too difficult to be with. He shouldn't be here. He's too hard to be with. And they were astonished. They told the leader that they were astonished that he was creating such a difficult problem for them. And then the leader explained. He says, this old man is like yeast for bread. Without him, you would not learn about anger or irritability or impatience or compassion. And that's why I have hired him to be in your midst. He is here to stay, so accept him as he is. Make him part of your life. In that way, give your life to him. So this story is a parable. It means we, all of us, have to welcome our own old man. We have to welcome and be honest with our habits and our tendencies. And we should make a vow to be attentive to them and not become overwhelmed. In this way, we will develop a giving mind rather than a closed mind. So that whatever we may do becomes a gift to ourselves and to others. Does anyone have a question tonight? Yes, Bonnie.
As you were describing the old man that was causing problems for everyone, I couldn't help but, I just came from a work happy hour. I didn't drink, but everyone is, there's one person that everyone in like the organization has problems with. He's like notorious to work with across departments. And so it was like some of his ex-employees that have moved to other departments, some of his current employees that are drinking, you know, so I can't help but think of this guy, and my strategy has been kind of to avoid. Just, you know, don't cause trouble, don't make waves, say hi, you know, but don't try to really work with him, try to work around him and work on separate things. But he's a very prominent presence in our department, and I don't really have, I guess my question is, you know, is there a better way? And part the main thing with him that drives everyone crazy is, I think either because he's a bit insecure or else territorial, I'm not sure which, but he blocks people. Like, even people who are under him, who he's supposed to be promoting, like they're doing good and they're working for him, he'll put roadblocks in front of them to slow their progress. So I guess, you know, is there a better way? Should I try to incorporate him somehow? what are my options?
Be polite and courteous and gracious. That's the most comfortable way. And when there comes a time when you have to do work together and reach agreements and make commitments, make promises, you do it mindfully and carefully with your understanding of how he is. But the thing is to try to keep some relationship always. No, don't break. Try to keep some relationship. And he may notice, and it may be of benefit to him, but you will notice, and it will be of benefit to you, your own giving nature. So express it whenever you can in any situation. Yes, Umar?
So, last two things came to my mind when you're giving this talk, and one was that old movie came to my mind, Network, where the man says that, I want you to go to the window and stick your head out the window and say, I'm mad as hell, I know I'm not going to take it anymore. And that came up, and I was like, wow, this is interesting. But then I realized why it came up, because I used to have a neighbor in San Francisco, and he was old, sort of curmudgeon-y, sort of a man, and nobody wanted to talk to him. I used to go and talk to him all the time, say hello, and how are you? So one night I sat with him and didn't realize it was morning, and he was telling me stories from his youth, but one of the important stories that he told me and stuck with me and is that he said when he was growing up, he had the neighborhood that he lived in, it was a poorer part of town, and there was this woman who used to live in that neighborhood who used to stick her head out the window and say that if I don't spend the rest of my day making everybody miserable, I haven't achieved my life's purpose. So he said, from that, I learned to always keep my head up high. You know, keep my head up and never let anything bring me down, no matter what came my way. So that woman's comments were uplifting to him. It turned him into a better person. And that's what he taught me. He said, no matter what happens, you have to keep your head up. Just wanted to share that.
Good, thank you. Yes, Richard.
Les, you were talking about that we have bodhisattva nature, and we may not feel like it, but it's there in the background or underneath. I think that's what you said. And that reminded me from a scene from a movie. It was a Hollywood movie, like a cop movie. And the two cops had rushed into a house on fire to save children or a pet or something. And then the community was lauding them as heroes, you know. But they didn't feel like heroes. They did what they had to do, and their wives were upset with them for risking their lives. They were standing in a convenience store getting some drinks, and one of them said, I wonder what it feels like to be a hero. And the other one also was like struck, like, I don't know. I don't know what it feels like. They didn't recognize that in themselves, even though the people around them recognized it. Does that capture, is that similar to what you were describing of bodhisattva nature? Or do you care to comment on that?
Oh, sure. Yes, that's one aspect of the bodhisattva nature. To do what we can for people, to be helpful to people in whatever circumstances present themselves, and to maintain a humility about it and not consider it anything unusual. Just to do what's spontaneous and natural for us. And if other people call us a hero, not to get carried away by that kind of praise, just to say, I just did what I was supposed to do. This is bodhisattva spirit. To do what we're supposed to do, whatever is in front of us that needs to be taken care of, we step forward and we do it. You don't remember the name of the film?
Was in it. It was, they were like, okay. Los Angeles cops.
Oh, okay. I'll look for it.
Jake Gyllenhaal, but I don't
know. Los Angeles cops. Okay. Yeah. I'll look for it. Thank you.
That's
every
movie.
Yes, Teresa, please.
So in the story you told, this spiritual leader decides to bring back the annoying old grumpy man because he will be kind of a teacher to the students. So I was wondering, who is the teacher of this difficult man?
Everybody and everything that he is associated with in his life is his teacher. There is the leader who came to get him and invited him back. There are the people in the community who will learn to be accepting of him. And then there's himself as he starts to notice how he has been towards everybody. So for all of us, it's everything around us that's our teacher. And, you know, we discover our teachers when we pay attention. Thank you.
You said at one point that to live in that state of giving mind is you have to have a very, very large perspective of the world. And it does seem like that makes perfect sense. It does seem like you do have to be in this place of a very big perspective. And then it strikes me that you're also, and I sort of notice myself hesitating to even say the word, but it seems like a very powerful place to be in. And I know that this isn't a talk about power, and obviously the minute you sort of see yourself in that powerful place, I'm sure it takes you right back down the slope, but just wondering if you would speak to that piece of the power that it does give you and how you work with that.
I don't think the feeling is one of, you know, power in the ordinary sense. It's a feeling of freedom. A kind of newfound freedom or an expanded freedom, that feels powerful. So it doesn't feel like we have some special power, but now we feel free. And that makes us feel powerful. Thank you. Yes, please.
Can you talk a little bit more about goallessness? Because what I gathered is that you want to practice dana because you kind of have this goal of expressing this bodhisattva ideal, but this is kind of the opposite of goallessness. So couldn't you kind of like explain the differences between these two? So you said during Zazen, we practice Zazen goallessness, right? Without a goal.
Without a goal. Oh. Right?
But we also kind of practice dana with this goal of expressing the bodhisattva. Oh. So yeah. Can you explain the difference here?
So when we have a mind of dana, there's we can't really have a mind of dana if we have a goal. If we offer something and we want something in return or expect something in return, it's a nice gesture, but it is not what we know as dana. If we give something and don't expect anything in return and are not disappointed when it's not returned, this is a dana. So there is no goal associated. With a giving mind. We don't even have a goal of selflessness. Because we understand that selflessness is inherent, we don't need to acquire it. It's not a goal. So rather than considering goals and objectives of our activities, we focus more on the activities themselves, to do them fully, to do them with quality, to do them with a generous feeling. Each thing we do. So when we can avoid being caught up with the idea of goals, we do find this freedom. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.